illumines, advanced in all the forms of alchemy and Rosicrucianism and philosophy and mysticism, only as the result of internal growth. They grew from within themselves only. Their source of inspiration was within their own hearts. They were the heart enlightened ones, and their authority came from the depths of their own natures. This was recognized as a major department of the instructed. Among the most important, of course, of the Illumines was Socrates, who was self-initiated. That is, that he became aware through inward contemplation of the teachings and doctrines normally communicated by the mysteries. Because he was not an initiate, he was not forbidden to speak. But discretion, again, governed these people as in most other levels of mystical insight. Secrecy was not for the purpose of withholding knowledge. It was the protection of knowledge. And those who were self-initiated also were required to protect the sources of their instruction. Another famous Illumine was St. Francis. Again, another was the famous German mystic Böhme. These people grew from within the seeds of their own consciousness. And today, this is regarded as a valid form of instruction. And it is valid because, for the most part, the modern truth seeker has to belong to this classification. He has to find his way, not through the official assistance of the state, as in antiquity, but as a result of the contrition, as a result of the dedication, and the mystical insights that develop within himself. The Illumine was usually an individual who passed through an initiational ceremony in his personal life. In other words, his life became his initiation. He faced the problems of daily living. He was often under very heavy burden of stress and pain and sorrow. Very frequently, his life was tragic. But these were the testings of his own spirit. And those who survived, and most of them did, of course, were finally rewarded by a consolation of spirit arising within their own natures. This is where the average person of today finds himself in connection with his search for truth. The secular arts and sciences are well classified. If we wish to hire an attorney or a physician, we can get a resume, find the qualifications, and decide whether or not the person has the background we require. But in philosophical and religious matters, it is much more difficult. It is very hard to find a well-organized program by means of which an individual can advance his own spiritual convictions. Therefore, in most cases, the person has to work it out for himself. In so doing, he gains. He gains much more, probably, because it is much more important to us to learn through doing than to having someone tell us. But in these problems, there are certain difficulties arise also, one of which is discrimination. It is not easy for the average person to discriminate his own feelings. It is not very easy for him to estimate his own inner experiences and say these are genuine and these are not. It is very hard for the person to judge critically his own accomplishments. He is so desirous of believing that all is well, or that he is growing rapidly, or that everything is fine, that he lacks discrimination, discretion, and careful thinking. Now, one of the problems that faces most of the people who are now working with religious matters is that while the Orthodox denominations are fairly well integrated, those that are outside the fields of Orthodoxy still remain a kind of strange, dim confusion. There are many able and dedicated people in the field. Their findings do not necessarily synchronize. The sincere individuals come to different conclusions, different attitudes, and have different points of view. And the novice starting out has great trouble trying to discover an approach to the needs of his own life, an approach that is secure and sound. The real answer to all of these situations, of course, is that the mind itself, the judging instrument, the protecting power in the life of each person, must be able to handle the situation. And usually it is not. Sometimes it can handle in part, but not entirely. Now, the purpose of the mind, as far as protecting us is concerned, is to weed out things that are of their own nature and kind, doubtful, uncertain, conflicting, contradictory. And yet, we don't generally use the mind in this way. We are much more likely to use it to support whatever dominant interest we have at the moment. If we are sold on something, the mind helps to keep us sold and does not cooperate for us with us in order to find out the real basic facts involved. Now, in mysticism, which by its very nature implies mystery, we have a factor that is very difficult to work with, and that is the unknown. We have to work with the mysterious. And in so doing, we have to try to remove the mystery factor, because no one really functions well in the presence of the unknown. When we do not understand, superstitions increase, misinterpretations abound, and the individual can go off on side tracks and never return. So it is necessary to try, first of all, to get rid of unknown factors. Now, in a student-teacher relationship, it is very important that the teacher defends the right of the student to know the facts involved. The surrounding of facts with mysteries in order to bolster up uncertainties is wrong. If a certain teaching is pronounced by a teacher, the pupil has a perfect right to say, where did it come from? Who is responsible for this teaching? When did it begin? How does it prove itself in daily life? And where a difficult, mysterious, or secret instruction is involved, the teacher must be in a position to tell simple facts of life to the student. And if the teacher says that he is bound by obligation not to tell, then he, by the same rule, should be bound in obligation not to bring up the subject. In other words, stay with what he can explain, what he can tell, what he can do, and never put on an air of mystery and say that these things are just too deep for common understanding. If they're too deep to be understood, they're too deep to be mentioned. Now, this problem is quite common in the field, that the individual has some feelings about the possibility of adding a depth or dimension of importance to a subject by mystery. Avoid it. Avoid trying to do it yourself. If someone asks you a question in connection with philosophy or with religion, do not take the attitude, well, that will be revealed in one of the higher grades. Either answer the question or else prove conclusively at the point where the information comes from. Mysterious implications are floating around these days by the thousand, and they are not good. They demoralize and disintegrate the defense mechanism of the individual against imposture. Now, it isn't always actually imposture. But, for instance, we can say to someone, where did you get this idea from? Where is the source of this instruction? Now, there can be a mysterious thing involved, or we can come out frankly and say, well, it began with a dream experience. I had an inner experience, and this is what it was. And this is what I believe it means. But because of the fact that it is an experience that came to me uniquely, and for which I have no official support other than the experience itself. The individual who listens to it has a right to make his own findings, to decide for himself whether he considers it adequate and or proper or well enough authenticated. Now, for the most part, this type of thing is not necessary, because nearly every idea that we have in the field of religious philosophy is old. There's very, very little that is essentially new. Practically every concept that is necessary to help the individual to live better today has been available for thousands of years. It isn't the absence of ideas that has resulted in the difficulties we face. It's the fact that the average person is not sufficiently interested in the solution of problems. What the average person wants is to do as little as possible and enjoy life as far as he can. He doesn't want to take on discrimination or does not wish to discipline his own appetites. And because of lack of discipline, he is unable to judge the values involved in a religious decision. Everything we need for daily growth is available. It's available, practically all of it, in solid print somewhere. It is available in great classic texts. It is available in the writings of the world teachers. It is available in traditions that have descended for thousands of years and been held in the highest veneration. There is nothing more that is necessary in the form of mystery. Now, it is true, beyond all doubt, as, for example, in the word mystery, when we look it up in the dictionary, the word mystery has as its first meaning religion. Today, our idea of mystery is more apt to be a mystery story or a detective play. But the original meaning of the word mystery is a sacred rite. And the most frequently referred to mystery in Christianity is the Eucharist. Mystery, therefore, is actually a spiritual experience. It is not a secret thing. It is a spiritual involvement in the common affairs of living. And the individual does not, as a result of mystery, come into something that is unknowable or unknown. It is something, however, that is a spiritual revelation based in deity. And in this sense of the word, we cannot go any further. The abstract mystery of regeneration, redemption, these things rest in the substance of deity. This we cannot hope to explain or define other than in terms of interpretation. But there is no essential reason why these things cannot be forthrightly and practically discussed. What we have to try to do is to realize that when someone in the midstream of life suddenly becomes involved in the experience of a religious need, suddenly comes upon a way of life religiously that is different from what they have previously known, and they find this new way of life helpful, useful, solutional, inspiring, and constructive, they nearly always want to share this knowledge with other people. This is perfectly normal and natural. In order to share this knowledge, it becomes necessary for the newly acquired knowledge to be analyzed, dissected, and digested by the person to whom it is given. Someone comes along and over the back fence and says, "I've just read a book that's just wonderful. You should read it." Well, so the book is handed over the fence and a line of belief is transmitted. Now, what this belief is, the man who hands the book over the fence may not know, and the one who receives it knows less. But it is something that seems to inspire, seems to help, seems to give justification or support in the problems of life. And today especially, we are all reaching out for this type of support. We are all experiencing the need of inspiration, of encouragement, and of some type of vital doctrine to give us new securities within our own nature. Paul was right beyond all question when he pointed out that there is only, finally, one security, and that is the security of faith. The final answer to all the questions relating to man's spiritual experience must be faith. faith in the reality of things unseen. Faith in the existence of something superior to the problem which we now face. Faith in future, faith in self, faith in loved ones, faith in nations and in the world. Everywhere there must be a faith upon which to build. But faith, unfortunately, has to be supported in some way. Faith floating in the air doesn't seem to do very well. Faith is not only a problem of a belief in realities. Faith is an ability, in a sense at least, to rationalize realities. Let us take an example of a person such as Plato. Plato was essentially a philosopher. But like most philosophers, he discovered in the course of time that philosophy is a rather dry, dusty subject. He found that he could study philosophy all he wanted to and come to some tremendously vibrant, vital, practical conclusions. And yet philosophy didn't give all the answers. What philosophy did give him was the power to discriminate. Philosophy helped him to organize common sense. Philosophy was actually disciplined common sense. In some mysterious way, philosophy helps to prevent the mind from going off the deep end. It helps the individual to think things through. It helps the individual to weigh values, to determine what is honest, what is not honest, to decide for himself the results of cause and effect in their pattern sequences in his own living. So philosophy gives the person a discriminating point of view. Having achieved this, having come to a certain realization of what is fair, what is just, what is honest, what is honorable, then the individual can project these concepts toward the abstraction of faith. Faith is more or less the individual's heart, supported by the findings of his mind. Faith is a direct experience of believing, but faith is made content or made rational through organizing mental resources. So wherever there is a faith, we have to build something under it. And whether we realize it or not, we drift inevitably towards philosophy, because philosophy is trying to help us to supply a rational point of view. It is helping us to prove, for example, that God is absolutely necessary. Faith is the recognition of a divine principle. But the individual can say, I can be an atheist or an agnostic, I can accept or I can reject. Philosophy says, no, you can't. Philosophy tells us that if you think it through, you have to come to faith. If you think through the creation, you have to face the creator. If you think through the laws of nature, you have to find the lawmaker. So that the mind disciplining belief prepares the way to support the highest of all faith, and that is faith in the absolute perfection of the divine purpose. Now, when we start out trying to help people with problems, we have to try to find ways in which we can share beliefs that are valuable to us, and at the same time, not subject the listener to difficulties. It is a mistake to assume that knowledge is transmitted finally through words. It is not. Knowledge is transmitted through insights which have to be developed within the person themselves. So whenever a new student or a new person becomes interested in the involvements of a philosophic life, it is very important that the teacher, whoever it may be, begins on the level of deportment. Now, this is where most teachers do not begin, and they find it too discouraging if they do. The moment you tell an individual that he has to change himself in some way, you're apt to lose a disciple. He wants to remain as he is and be better at the same time. He wants to recover from all of the sorrows of ignorance, but he wants to remain ignorant. Now, this point of view has to be faced whenever you attempt to communicate knowledge. Knowledge has to be communicated on a progressive basis. The individual has to learn that he has to grow, and that knowledge that does not support growth, or growth that is not supported by knowledge, is not valuable. So when the time comes to try to inspire a person, you have to begin with what is commonly called the cathartic methods of discipline. These were the ancient Greek mysteries of the ancient temple rites. The first thing you have to say to the individual, or try to convince the individual, is that if he wishes to become better, he must outgrow those parts of himself which are preventing him from being better. It is not that we pass on the cosmic law, the universal harmony, and infinite providence and plenty. It is the individual ready or willing to make the changes in his own inner life which will make growth possible? If he is not so conditioned, he will become simply an intellectualist. He will have a lot of answers, but he will not be able to apply them to himself. He will be able to discuss all these principles, but they move across the surface of his own life with practically no effect upon him. He can believe in reincarnation for a lifetime, discuss it, try to convert other people to it, but never live as though it meant anything to him. Never becomes part of a determination to change his own policies, to deserve a better embodiment. To deserve a better embodiment is the primary end of the doctrine. If the individual learns the doctrine but does not change himself, the fact that he has learned it will not provide him with the better embodiment that he's looking for. He must make everything that he learns mean something in his own daily conduct. He must grow constantly in grace of spirit. He must do the things that he believes. If he does this, because it's consistently, with a little quiet leadership, he will gradually reach a point where he can experience some of the transformations referred to in the matter of illumination. These transformations arise when the person changes his own orientation. He cannot remain as he is and be different. And the only way he can grow or outgrow a problem is to become a solver of that problem, never to escape it, never to avoid it. It is useless for him to try to mentally cast off the problem as long as he doesn't solve it in his own life. So when you start out on yourself or anyone else in matter of teaching, make sure that every new idea that comes into your consciousness produces a change in conduct. Let it be, if possible, a gradual improvement of the whole nature. Now, most persons starting out in these fields, in middle life especially, come to philosophy or idealism or mysticism because of difficulties. They are sad, they are burdened, they are sick, they have broken homes and wayward children, they have all kinds of difficulties, financial, personal, psychological, emotional, mental, and occasionally serious physical ailments. These people are therefore looking for something more than they have previously had in the form of insights. They are looking for some way to straighten themselves out. Now, they may not put it quite so clearly as that. What they are really saying to themselves probably is that they want to know something that will change these problems. They don't want to change themselves primarily, but it gradually becomes evident that they will have to. But having decided to try to find a better answer to the problem of life, then, of course, as we have always pointed out, the first thing you have to do is take the personal inventory. What is the matter? Now, the average personal inventory consists principally
of trying to prove why other people are responsible for our miseries. It's surprising how few people have ever done anything wrong themselves. They're all victims. Well, a lot of people are victims, let's face it. As particularly, they are victims of social problems, of the tremendous shifts and change and crises and world events. They are in trouble, and at the first look, it doesn't seem as though it's all their own fault. In some cases, it looks a little that way, but in some instances, there seem to be legitimate excuses. But the only excuses that are legitimate at all are those which arise from natural ignorance. The individual who doesn't know any better is apt to be in certain troubles. But if he doesn't know more and learn to know better, he will stay in those problems. So he can start in to find out what his own resources are. He'll try to discover just what kind of a person he is. And sometimes one of the best ways to try to figure that out is to do what the Pythagorean disciplines did, cause the individual to go back over his life in reverse and see exactly the effects of the various causations for which he was responsible. The individual who bought that non-existing stock because he thought he was going to make 25% premium a year on it and resulted in loss of everything, was responsible. He wanted an unreasonable profit, so he lost. If he had been conservative and practical, he might have been all right. But in his greed, he destroyed himself. And time after time, the mistakes that we make ourselves become our own undoing. Usually because of ulterior motive, usually because we have got some kind of a little conspiracy in the back of our mind somewhere, or because of some desire to notoriety or fame or distinction or wealth or something. So we have to start in by going over these and finding out what the troubles are. It gradually becomes evident, as was taught in the Greek mysteries, that a certain purging is indicated. You have to clean up the life. You have to get rid of those elements in the life which are not worthy of you. You have to get rid of those endless arguments and dissensions, those bad spells of disposition, the temper fits and the hysterias and the gloom and the blames, and we have to get over living in the past. I know an individual who has been living in the past every day for the most of the present lifetime, and yet the one thing they're grateful for is that they don't live in the past. They don't even know it. So you have to wake up to some of these facts. You have to wake up to the fact that old grievances are still working. And you are looking for knowledge. You are looking for understanding, for insight. You're looking for faith and hope and love. You're looking for to be a better person. And you have to get over yourself as a stumbling block. So that is where all instruction has to start. The individual doesn't have to wait until he's reformed before he tries to learn anything. But he should make a voluntary obligation to himself that with every new idea that he gets, with every new interpretation of life, he is going to correct a personal fault. If he will do that, he will find his growth is much more rapid. Now, some people are placed in positions where it doesn't seem possible for them to perhaps to correct these faults very rapidly. Situations are dominating their lives, and they cannot resist the pressures of them. But there is another angle to this also. It is possible, very often, to reduce and simplify life. Most people are too complicated. They're also too much set in ancient ways. One thing many people will have to do, probably, is to reevaluate what life has already meant to them. If a person reaches 50 or 60 with a certain life pattern, one of two things must happen. Either they're going to carry that pattern to the grave with them, which is the line of least resistance, or they're going to make a very severe and hard effort to break it and start out on a new pattern while it's still possible to do something with it. Wherever a pattern that brought a person to middle life discontented, unhappy, unadjusted, insecure, and frightened, that pattern has to be changed. If it isn't changed, they will go out of this world into the next life frightened to death. So that the problem is to take your philosophy, if you've got an idea, to do something with it, and do it now, and use it, and make something out of it. So with that point in mind, you now turn on the philosophy for a moment and see what this particular idea that you're interested in is going to do for you. If this idea is going to simply enable you to accomplish what is accredited of St. Thomas Aquinas, namely, as a result of great meditation, he was able to count the number of angels that could dance on the head of a pin. If this is this type of instruction, I'd forget about it. You're not here to find out why something on some other planet somewhere else is better off than we are. We're not here to dream of utopian escapes out of this world. We're not here to work with subjects which, after we've learned them, leave us exactly what we were before. We can learn all about the mysteries of the universe and still remain tired, disconnected, discontented people. So whatever you're going to take on has got to have utility. It's got to have value right now. It's got to do something for you with the problems you face today. It is not the type of thing in which you can afford to follow a belief that is going to make things marvelous for you 10,000 years from now. You have to start now. So whatever you're studying must help to make you the person you must be to solve your own problem. So you can remember that some of these byways are perfectly fascinating. You can learn more and more about less and less, until, as Albert Hubbard said, you know all about nothing. Some of these philosophies and the beliefs are charming. And if the individual is happy, well-adjusted, and likes to have a little recreational reading, fine. You can have a lot of pleasure with it. But you have to have something that gets at the facts. The facts right now. And these facts are that you must improve your personal relationships with life. Now, how do we improve personal relationships with life? First of all, we have to take on an attitude which nearly all great religious systems have affirmed, namely that we are here to learn. We are here to grow. We are here to do something. We are not here to float around on flowery beds of ease. We are not here for the gay life, or for the wealthy life, or for lack of responsibility, or to spend all of our time in leisure and dissipation. We are here to learn something. And until that becomes a basic part of our commitment, we are not going to get out of this problem what we should. So if we will remember that we are here to be better every day in actual, factual growth, that we are a little more honest every day, a little more kind every day, that we have better control of our tongues, that we have better discipline in our relations with life, that we use our funds better, that we take better care of all responsibilities that come along, and that less and less are we concerned with the primary satisfactions of our own desires. Gradually, we get into harmony with the law of living. And when we do that, then we begin to see how we can grow and teach and become helpful to other people. So the catharsis should come first. Any individual who wants to grow should be assisted or directed in preparing a plan for growth. And this plan should not be to make life easier. It's to make life better, with the realization that in the end, in the long run, the better life will be the easier. But in the meantime, it may require considerable discipline and some self-sacrifice to make it work. So in the next point that we want to try to bring up is the relationship as it was found in the Orient between a teacher and a disciple. This is a very touchy situation, especially in the West. Because in the West, we do not believe in anybody obeying anything. The individual wishes to do precisely as he pleases. To us, freedom is the right to make mistakes. And if anyone tries to prevent us from making mistakes, we get real surly about it. We're not very happy. We do not recognize that freedom is the right to be right. And that freedom is also the possibility of being right, regardless of circumstances. So instead of following the old Oriental pattern of learning to lead by following, we want to start by leading. We want to begin where discipline really should be in midstream, rather than to start at the beginning. The old Indian guru system was based upon the individual learning to obey on different levels. And the learning to obey was a quiet method of getting over self-will. In the old Babylonian Talmud, it said, self-will was the cause of the fall of the angels. Self-will is, I will do as I please. And the only way you can get over that is to discipline it. And in the Indian system of education, the discipline began with the gurus. The guru is an elderly gentleman. He'd be the last person in the world to tell you that he was divine. He wasn't. He was a kind of philosophic parent, trying to do what most parents do not try to do, and that is to truly mature their children. The old guru was a mentor. The disciples lived with him over periods of years, worked with him every day. And in every instance, his will was law. No one would have thought of crossing him. No one would have disobeyed him on any account, because he became a symbol of discipline. When the disciple became wiser than the teacher, he went to another and more advanced teacher. But the teacher did not try to run his life simply because he could get away with it. The teacher was there to make certain that the disciple in all things was obedient first to his teacher, second to the laws of the universe, and third to God. These obediences were necessary. Without them, there could be no growth. So today, when the person learns something of a nature more advanced than the commonplace, he has the problem of being obedient to it. He has the right and necessity to obey truth as it is given to him to understand truth. If truth says, thou shalt not steal, he will not steal. If the truth says, thou shalt love thine enemy, he will love him. Because this is obedience to a law bigger than personal feelings. And until we outgrow the personal feelings, we will never experience the divine feelings. So in each instance, the individual is moving towards obedience to higher convictions of life. And in so doing, he is gradually enlightening, broadening, deepening the foundations of his own integrity. And having come to a certain degree of integrity, he is then in a position to make decisions that are completely impersonal, completely fair, completely just, and completely good. Until he is able to make these decisions, he cannot go on to a higher level of insight. So we have to try to bear in mind that with all the studying that we do, that we mustn't simply assume that we can read our way into nirvana. We must take thoughts and make these thoughts, where we understand them and believe them, an essential part of our own instruction. There are many very lovely and beautiful little books that have been written, like Thoreau's Walden and some of these books, that have wonderful messages in them for simple people who are willing to live the dignity of their own simple life. There are beautiful thoughts for all of us that will enrich us and ennoble us. But when we find a beautiful thought, it's not enough to memorize it or to say how wonderful it is. We must immediately put it to work. It must mean something right now. If we are able to apply these beautiful thoughts as we are capable of understanding them, gradually we will modify and contain the pressures within ourselves with greater dignity. Having reached a point in which there is no longer conflict between what we want and what we need, we are coming very close to the entrance to the sanctuary. We are coming very close to that condition in which it is going to be possible for us to go on into the more positive forms of discipline beyond what we are doing at the moment. Having gone through the purging problem, the purification problem, the individual enters the sanctuary for the next step. And this next step is dedication. Having prepared the body, the mind, the personality for service, having dedicated the life to the service of good, of truth, of deity, and of our fellow human being, we are then ready to go on and prepare for the ministry that we may have, whatever it may be. So the second or higher degrees of these rites had to do with the basic instructions which could be communicated and which would assist the individual to live the good life. It becomes a matter in which the person no longer lives for himself. He becomes truly the pen in the hand of the ready writer. He becomes an instrument of the universal purpose, with no desire to be anything else. Now, in doing this, however, we mustn't assume that he necessarily goes off into the wilderness somewhere and becomes a hopeless ascetic or someone who has given up all contact with life. This is not it. The answer is that the individual has become dedicated to the doing of that which is the best he knows, and that in this procedure he will try to serve others in the capacities that are within his own means. Now, in India and many of these other foreign countries, capacities are determined very largely by background skills. Supposing we say that an individual has become a physician, and as a physician, he has then gone on and become a disciple of some Indian teacher. Or perhaps he became a physician, like in my little story of the guru, because that was what his teacher wanted him to be. And, of course, his teacher's word was law. But anyway, this man has become a physician, and he is now a disciple of a school. He is part of a hierarchy of the guru's structure, as it is in India. Immediately it becomes obvious that regardless of anything, any circumstance that may arise, selfishness has died in that doctor. Abuse of any privilege is impossible. Exploitation of his profession is impossible. The neglect of the sick because the sick are poor is impossible. Everything is now tied around a pivot of integrity. And whatever that profession may be, it must be always honorable, completely and formally in integrities alone.
We find it in Japanese Buddhism. We find in the Amida sect, particularly, that the path of discipleship is simply a path of honor that is impossible